Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
34.
Here's John Williams.
I'll take that. How are you? This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here weekdays 1 to 3, Saturdays 10 to noon on social media. Look for me as WGN King John. Don't forget the Mincing Rascals podcast drops tonight at 5. Judge the best podcast in Chicago. Listen for the Mincing Rascals.
You can't begrudge her style, your Auntie Griselda.
This is Peter Tork.
She couldn't budge a smile and do it for free.
He did not sing many songs for the Monkees.
So righteous making fudge, your Auntie Griselda. So proper judging others over her tea. You look just like her, you do. I know by looking at you that you've been listening to your Auntie Griselda.
But I remember that song. That was fun. But it wasn't this, now was it?
I thought love was only true and fair tale.
Peter Tork has passed away at the age of 77.
For someone else, but not for me.
Oldest member of the Monkees when they were a group.
Love was out to get me. That's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face.
This is such a nostalgia trip. I know some of you don't know who the Monkees are, and if you do, you don't get it. And there's no explaining it, but if you're of a certain age, and you do not have to be that old to appreciate the Monkees, that was such a fun group. The songs were so good. There was a little bit of controversy about the authenticity of the sound and yada, 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 which just makes the whole story that much more interesting and easier to even champion them because they were that fun musical group and the TV show was so much fun. And now another one of them, Peter Tork, has passed away from a rare form of cancer. Here's what a big deal they were musically, though. In 1967, according to I'm reading now from the Washington Post, and I think this has been posted on the Tribune site as well. In 1967, the Monkees sold 35 million albums, which was twice as many as the Beatles and Rolling Stones combined. Thanks to songs like Daydream Believer and I'm a Believer and Last Train to Clarksville, all rose to number one on the Billboard chart.
What year was that, John?
1967.
Wow.
So the Beatles were there.
That's Sgt. Pepper, I think, isn't it?
The Rolling
Stones. No, 67, I think.
Go ahead.
I think that was the Sgt. Pepper album for the Beatles.
Wow. I'm not as good on the Stones and the Beatles as I am on the Monkees. And it helped that Carole King and Jeffrey Goffin and Neil Diamond and David Gates and Neil Sedaka wrote their stuff. I don't care. All I know is they were really fun to watch. The TV show was very funny. And the songs were terrific. So who cares? He was the son of an economics professor from the University of Connecticut. At the age of 9, he demonstrated an aptitude for music, learned to play several different instruments. And the way that he got on the show is kind of interesting. He attended Carleton College before he moved to New York City. Carleton College in Minnesota. Artsy-fartsy, expensive school for smart people. He became part of the folk music scene in Greenwich Village during the first half of the 1960s, and there he met a guy, and they became friends. His friend was named Stephen Stills. Stephen Stills, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, all that. Stephen Stills had auditioned for the new TV series that some people were making about four pop rock musicians, but they didn't cast Stephen Stills because the show's producers felt that his hair and teeth would not photograph well on the camera. They said, do you know anybody else with a similar sort of open Nordic look? He said, well, I know this guy named Peter Tork. Peter Tork became one of the Monkees. He was a proficient musician, but again, they weren't interested in that. And on the first couple albums, they didn't even get to play the instruments. Six albums were produced with the original Monkees lineup, four of which went to number one on the Billboard chart. And then 2 years of that popular TV show, which, by the way, their TV show won an Emmy for Best Comedy TV Series. But the group was no longer getting the dynamic that he wanted. Groups, you know, never stay together for very long. And after they toured and then recorded that movie Head, he said he was exhausted. And so Peter Tork bought out the remaining 4 years of his contract after filming the movie. Cost him $150,000 back then. He struck out on his own, formed a group called Peter Tork and or Release. By 1970, he was a solo artist again. He said, "I didn't know how to stick to it, and I ran out of money." He was forced to sell his house in 1970. He and a pregnant Renee Stewart moved into the basement of David Crosby's home. Then he got arrested and convicted for the possession of hashish. He spent 3 months in an Oklahoma penitentiary in 1972. I did not know that about sweet face Peter Tork. He returned to Southern California in the mid-1970s, got married, had a son, and then started teaching at Pacific Hills School in Santa Monica for a year and a half. Actually, for 3 years, he taught music and social studies, math, French, history. He was the baseball coach of the team at the school. In 1986, after a 1985 tour with Davy Jones in Australia, Tork rejoined fellow Monkees Davy Jones and Mickey Dolenz for a highly successful 20th anniversary reunion tour. So help me, I have it in my mind that I saw them in Peoria when they were out on the road, but that may not be true. He also had a pair of appearances more recently on the sitcom Boy Meets World. In 2008, he added advice columnist to his resume. He authored an online advice info column called Ask Peter Tork at the website The Daily Panic. I didn't know that either. He reported in 2009 on his website he had been diagnosed with a rare, slow-growing form of head and neck cancer. In 2009, a spokesperson for Tork reported that his cancer had returned. He was reportedly shaken but not stirred by the news and said that the doctors had given him an 80% chance. Peter Tork has passed away as a result of that cancer. It's 1:14. This is WGN. Steve and I were talking briefly before the break. We'll pause now and come back with somebody who is with an organization called Companion Animals and Endangerment Program at the Humane Society International, Kelly O'Meara. She's the vice president. And here's the deal. They rescue pets, sometimes at extraordinary cost and effort. And they brought a bunch of them to the Chicago area. Did you see this story? The details on that in a minute. So there was a story on TV the other day, and you may have read this in the Tribune as well. In part, the Chicago Tribune said, for more than 60 dogs rescued from a dog meat farm, their arrival at a suburban Chicago animal hospital this week marked the end of a long journey. A 12-hour flight from Seoul to Toronto, a 10-hour road trip aboard an 18-wheeler. They ended up in the Chicago area at the Animal Care Center in Elmhurst. They talk about the roughly 200 dogs rescued last week by Humane Society International from a South Korean dog meat farm and puppy mill as part of the organization's campaign to end the dog and cat meat trade. I did not know there was one. The dogs, everything from dachshunds and chihuahuas to large mixed breeds and border collies, arrived in suburban Chicago Tuesday and were taken by shelters and rescue groups in six Midwestern states, including Illinois. With matted fur shrouding his brown eyes, a poodle named Keith was greeted with a warm welcome by volunteers. You know, you can have whatever opinions you want about this story and this effort, but when you see those dogs, you think that's just so wrong for those dogs to be treated that way. While Humane Society International shuttered 14 dog meat farms and rescued about 1,700 dogs since 2015, an estimated 2.5 million dogs are slaughtered each year in South Korea. Again, I didn't know that. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this, what happened and how they do it. Vice President of the Companion Animals and Endangerment Program at the Humane Society International. So what's this program? What do you all do?
Well, in respect to the Korean Dog Campaign, we've been in Korea now for about 4 years. As you mentioned, we've now shut down 14 dog meat farms. Korea is a unique country in Asia, not in that it eats dog. There are a number of Asian countries that still consume dogs and cats. However, in Korea, it's unique because it is the only country that solely raises dogs on these dog meat, intensive dog meat farms for the purpose of their meat. And with that, you've had, you know, you have a lot of horrific conditions these animals live in. We've now visited countless of these dog meat farms throughout the country, and there are thousands, and they are located throughout the country. And the, in the thousands that we, you know, the many that we have visited, they're all the same conditions. There's just dogs in bare and metal cages. They're exposed to the elements, whether it be, you know, scorching hot or it be bitter cold as it is right now in South Korea. They get very little food. They get no veterinary care. So they, if they get injured or ill, they either get over it or they die in their cage. It's a really miserable existence until one day they're plucked from that cage and they're brought to the slaughterhouse to be killed. So it's a really sad existence for any animal, never mind, you know, dogs.
Who eats them?
Well, we've learned that that it's really mainly the older population in South Korea that consume dogs. The younger generation wants nothing to do with it. They not only don't consume dogs, they don't agree with the consumption of dogs. And what has really happened in South Korea in the last really 20 years is there's been a pet boom, and more and more people now have dogs as companions. And so they're seeing dogs in a different light and don't believe in the fact that the dog should, you know, any longer be used for the purpose of meat. There's also a very strong misconception that has, you know, been built over generations in South Korea that somehow there's a difference between what is a meat dog and a pet dog. And so that distinction in the eyes of the South Korean, you know, traditional sort of culture has allowed this industry to continue. When in fact, what we've been able to show in our campaign is all of these dogs are just dogs in a terrible situation. And a dog is a dog. It doesn't matter if it's raised on these farms for the purpose of meat. They're all just dogs. There's no difference between them, whether they be pet or raised for meat.
What is the cost to get a dog from South Korea to Elmhurst, Illinois?
Well, it certainly isn't inexpensive. We do spend a lot on this campaign, and that is certainly the most expensive component of it. Unfortunately, these dogs are not, because of that strong misconception and you know, internal stigma that's associated with these dogs that come from the dog meat farms, even if they're the small breeds that, in fact, you find in South Korean homes, there isn't a strong adoption culture that exists in South Korea right now, so there's no options for them to be rehomed in South Korea. We do hope that changes in time and through our campaign and awareness. But for now, they come overseas. They go to U.S., Canada. We've sent them to the U.K. and the Netherlands as well. The latest farm, we've sent all the dogs to Canada and the U.S. And it is expensive. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars for us to send this many dogs to their ultimate destination to be rehomed.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars to send a couple of hundred dogs from South Korea to Illinois. If the dogs were better treated, say if they had the kind of humane treatment that we'd like cows to receive in the United States, and we seem to be comfortable eating cows, would that change your operation at all? Is it that they're dogs, or is it that it's inhumane?
No, it's a good question. We really do focus on the cruelty aspect of it. I mean, the entire industry is a bit under the radar of the government. There's a lot of components to it that are already illegal under the existing laws in South Korea and a number of the Asian countries where this exists. The hygiene alone on these farms are horrendous. And are in and of themselves a health hazard for, you know, no doubt. And because this happens under the radar, there is no real oversight of it. But what we learned is that even if there was oversight of it and the dogs were treated more humanely and there was more attention given to how they were raised and what conditions they were raised under, it wouldn't be conducive to it wouldn't be cost effective for the farmers. These farmers are mainly unskilled workers or, you know, laborers, and they don't have the money to upgrade the farms
to
it's not really an option for them. It's also a dying industry, you know, both society and their, in many cases, their families. All of the farmers we've worked with, it's been their families who've been pushing them to get out of it. They see it as a dying industry, and they're looking for an opportunity to get out. So it's happening within South Korea, and it's South Koreans themselves that are pushing to expedite the end of this trade.
I don't know what kind of memory a dog has, but can you imagine what that dog must be thinking if it does? How bad their existence was, and how good it must feel to be in a living room in Elmhurst, Illinois, or somewhere in Iowa.
Right.
How many of the dogs have been excited
about that part of it.
How many of the dogs have been adopted? We got a couple of hundred here in the Chicago area. Have they all been spoken for?
Not at this point. In fact, there are still some dogs coming off the farm currently because of weather-related flights. We had to hold some back and push them to later flights. But that happens, you know, no matter what. I mean, we're at the mercy of the getting them over here. But the dogs that have been brought over, many have already been adopted straight from the moment they've arrived at these various different shelter partners. And so, many of the dogs, as you mentioned, are smaller breeds. They're dachshunds, there's chihuahuas, there's corgis, and a variety of others. Even among the more typical breeds you find on these farms, which are the Jindos and the Tosin mixes, which are the mastiff mixes. I mean, all of these dogs are incredibly sweet. We expect that all 200 will find homes very, very quickly.
What's the website for your organization?
It's hsi.org, and we have lots of information on there, and would love for people to come and visit and learn more about our overall campaign, because we're really doing this as a model for the South Korean government to hopefully adopt and move towards a phase out to ban of the dog meat trade. That's our ultimate goal.
HSI, as in Humane Society International.org. Kelly, good luck
Correct,
to you all.
Yes.
I appreciate your time. We'll be in touch, but congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Welcome back, John.
I was in my office where I have a little production set up. And I heard you wrapping up the weather, and I thought, I'm on after that.
Yeah, I've got, I try to get in and out. I don't try to dilly-dally.
Would have killed you to stretch that forecast
I didn't know you needed me to stretch it.
Whoo. Hey, John. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Can I just say, because people have been asking me what a trooper you were last night, that we did go and see the game together. And I was so glad you were there.
Last night, Butler University in Indiana played Marquette University of Wisconsin. Steve is a big Marquette guy. I'm a big Butler guy. I get emotionally wrapped up in these games. Steve does not. Lou Manfredini's got some money going to Marquette as well. And Lou thought it would be fun if us three pals got together and watched the game. I did not think it would be fun.
You did not want to do it.
And watch the game. I came home and Brenda said to me, are you going to go see Steve and Lou? And I said, no. And she goes, yes, you are. Go on. Go to the game. Get in the car. Drive up to this bar in Wilmette called Myers, which is awesome. And go watch the game. And I said, all right.
I was so happy when I walked in and saw you there.
Truly, this happened. So when I walk into the bar, Lou is the first one there, and he's got his beer ready, and he has a blow-up mannequin with a Butler hat ready to go.
That's right. Say it again. He had a blow-up mannequin.
And he was going to put that in the chair with the Butler hat because he knew I wouldn't make it. I made it so we didn't need the blow-up mannequin, but it was a lot of fun to watch him blow it up.
You know what? And I was thinking of that this morning. What a joyful guy that he actually thought of that.
Oh, my gosh.
Brought it, brought the hat, had all that stuff.
So then the game finally starts, and Steve and I are pretty laser-locked on it.
My buddy Alessio is there, so
terrific.
It's four of us.
So Alessio is there, too, just a delightful man, a friend of yours. And Lou, well, Alessio is a basketball fan, but he's not locked into this game the way you and I are. And Lou isn't especially interested in the game, it appears, at all. So while Steve and I are watching the game,
are doing our best,
I'm having heart palpitations. Lou's going, what do you think of this story? And I know what Lou is doing, I think. I think Lou is trying to manage the evening for me by making it as fun as possible. Hey, it's not about the game. We're just four guys having a beer. And I'm
right.
Like, no, I'm watching a game, and you three guys are whatever the hell you want to be.
So you and I were sitting across from each other, and Alessio, and so I was kind of, I almost switched seats so I could sit next to you and watch the game.
Yeah, but then you kept saying things like, are you having fun, John? John, how you doing? I'm like, shut up, Steve. I'm not having fun. I knew I wouldn't have fun.
Okay, but I didn't do that out of malice, right?
I thought you were just enjoying that a little bit.
No, I'm not that kind of fan at all.
No, I didn't. You weren't dancing.
I was saying things like, Theo John is the best center we've ever had.
I know that. What am I supposed to say about that? Is he's dunking on my team? I'm like,
which
yes.
Time?
Okay.
Okay, that's the only thing I'll say. That's the only thing.
Wow.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen. That was Pam. Hi,
that was Pam.
Hi.
Hi, Pam.
By the way, Mark Baser, a friend of this show, has just strolled into the studio. Be nice to me, Mark. I'm recovering from a Butler loss last night.
Sorry.
Thank you.
There was no sneaker explosion, though.
Oh, my
gosh.
Oh,
man. How about that?
So on the other screen, you've got Duke playing North Carolina. And early on, Zion Williamson, who's like the greatest player in the history of basketball. He's the next LeBron James, right?
That's what they say.
And he just, you know, he's driving towards the lane, hits the brakes, and his shoe explodes.
His Nike shoe. Because Nike's Nike doing shoe. Great damage control today.
They were down. Their stock was actually down 2% this morning.
Are they attributing that to that?
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
All right, so you sell a billion shoes, and then one of them goes bad on TV. And what, you're not going to buy Nike? I
mean, but their whole point of Nike, that with their mission, their brand mission that they put out there, is that they make you a better athlete. It's not like he had some bad McDonald's and got the flu or got a virus, a stomach virus, and couldn't play the game. It's the thing that's supposed to make you bring out the best in you as an athlete. It's going to do damage.
What would you do if you were Adidas or Puma or Keds?
Send them a free pair.
Send him 100 free pair. And then send him to school kids and buy, you know, I don't know. There's got to be people on both sides of that conversation working really hard right now to maximize the opportunity, the damage control or the opportunity.
Yeah, Adidas, our shoes don't explode.
That's what you do. You put up, like, fake explosions and see that they're not damaged.
Yeah.
The cruise missile, it's still fine.
Did you guys think that the White Sox should have tried to capitalize on the Cubs' misfortunes of the last 10 days? The Cubs didn't do anything really wrong.
You mean the political misfortunes?
Well,
the racist cable statements.
The cable TV deal, the email from the father, the fact that Trump gets drawn into this sometimes, although it doesn't belong in this conversation. They've had a bad week, the Cubs. So what do you do if you're the White Sox? How do you capitalize on that? Or do you not? You just go, you know what, let's not... celebrate somebody
else's. Well, the White Sox didn't have a good week either.
I know. Well, that was... So we just did the Mincing Rascals, our podcast.
I used to be invited on that.
And...
You used to be good when you were on it, too.
Thank you, Steve.
One of the questions was, who had a worse week, the Sox or the Cubs?
Yeah, that's...
What's your answer to that, Mark Baser?
It's absolutely the White Sox. The Cubs fans... I know Eric Zorn says he'll never watch another Cubs game as long as he lives, like he doesn't have cable. He's going to be watching opening day.
Before we get to why you're here, Mark Baser's got a show coming up. I just wanted to finish the conversation we had before the news, Mark.
Yeah, go
Steve.
Ahead.
We just interviewed somebody from the Humane Society International. Humane Society International.
Just the pet. It's Adopt a Pet Weekend.
They rescued pets from a mill and meat farm in South Korea. So they put those dogs, 200 of them, on jets.
Yeah.
On a jet, and they, because I don't think we have propeller planes anymore. Anyway, they fly them
on a boat
to Toronto, and then put them in a semi-tractor trailer and drive them from Toronto to Chicago. She said it's hundreds of thousands of dollars to save the couple hundred dogs from the meat farm in the mill in South Korea. And when you see one of these matted dogs living inside a cage, your heart just breaks. No animal should endure that. So it's easy to be very sympathetic. But I know how texting and Twitter works. And so I knew that after the conversation, we were going to get a lot of rah, 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 rah.
Be careful, Mark. He's just begging one of us to step in it.
And I just felt like I was about to. And right. I've gotten a little older and I've decided not to.
847, listen to the text. 847, great show, John. I'm going to try and adopt a dog. 630, when I went to Korea, I saw the dogs in dirty conditions and cages. My instinct was to pet the dogs. I was told not to get attached. At that point, I knew those weren't pets. 847, I can't handle these animal stories. They're so very sad. 847, what good is this to do to these animals? 224, not sure I truly understand the killing of dogs. And it goes on. Point being, a lot of sympathy to the cause of the Humane Society International in spending six figures to fly these dogs from South Korea. It's their money. They can spend it any way they want, and it's their mission. But I was expecting a lot of, what about the kids?
Right.
If you're going to save mammals on Earth and you're in Asia, why don't you pick up some Chinese and North Koreans while you're over there? Nobody said that. And I'm a little shocked because I know some of you are thinking it.
And are still smart enough to keep their mouths closed.
I don't know. I mean,
it's not I believe the phrase is zero-sum gain. If I knew that not saving the dogs over there would, in fact, benefit children somewhere, I think that's an easy equation to, solve, problem to solve. But it's not, right? If you say, no, I'm not going to save the dogs, no child benefits as a result of that decision. So I don't know that you know you have the moral high ground when you say I'm not going to do that.
Well, but also, you know, it's these weird things that we believe in or that really move us. Like you talked yesterday to the woman suing over the parkland. Right. And she's, you know, not unmoved for that. I mean, think what you could do with hundreds of thousands of dollars to help dogs in this country. Not that I'm worried about American dogs, but, you know, it's.
Yeah, you want to be an American.
Right. Make America safe for dogs. But, you know, that instead they're spending it all on this transportation from South Korea. It's an unusual thing.
Isn't it amazing, though?
And I think you should be able to eat dogs if you want to.
Well, there's the other.
That's what you didn't want to say, Steve.
Whoops, was that out loud?
That's what you didn't want to say.
I mean, a lot of Hindus are really worried about how we treat our cattle. It's
why shouldn't we be? They're all mammals. I mean, I don't know. Don't mammals win? Aren't we on mammal side?
I saw a video of a man. It was like an Instagram video of a man being reunited with a pig, I think it was, that had... He had saved the pig's life or something. I don't know the full story. I honestly, it was an Instagram thing that I spent 3 seconds on. But the pig was very affectionate with the man. And the takeaway from the video was that this pig remembers this guy and that they have a real bond. And then you start thinking, well, that's what I had for supper last night. And so different cultures are different. To your larger point, I don't know. You can't really get involved in... Weighing which cause is better than which other cause. You know, let's say I put my money into funding education at a school, and everybody would say, that's great. Great. Glad you did that. But there might be somebody who says, yes, but what about the kids who are in worse condition than the kids that were at the school? You can always draw lines. And so at the end of the day, it's a good thing that people are giving back, right? And trying to help their world and how they care about helping the world.
Kind of where I came on this. You see those dogs in those cages, and you go, oh my God, no animal should live like that.
And to her credit, she said it was more about the way the dogs were being treated than the fact that they were being consumed. Eaten.
I mean, you know, about the cultural bias. I do draw lines, though, and I think we all do that, Mark, of, well, you shouldn't give your money there. And
why does it cost so much money, though?
I don't know. Have you booked a flight from Seoul to Toronto to Chicago?
And I fit two dogs on one of those chairs, right?
200 of them, and there's rules and regulations about this. By the way, do you want to be a flight sitting next to 200 mangy dogs from South Korea?
Depends what the cost of the ticket is.
I'll say this, though. When you judge other people's generosity, when somebody gives $7 million to Notre Dame or Harvard, or one of those places that already have billion-dollar endowments. I do not understand that. I do not understand that. I'm happy for those institutions, but they just are generating interest and providing scholarships, but it's just money parked. Or it goes to even more fabulous buildings for fabulous people who are already going to have a fabulous life.
Okay, what if you went home tonight and bought a nice bottle of gin, as you're wont to do? You could buy a cheaper bottle of gin and give the money to the leftover money to a cause, but you don't. You choose to spend the money the way you want to, and you hopefully at the end of the day feel like you've lived a moral and as generous as you can be life. So I guess
really? So you judge me that way, the way I would judge somebody's donation to somebody who really doesn't need it that much anymore? I mean, I think that donation to a university, if you've got $1 million, could do so much more good if you gave it to a local school.
It definitely could. There's no argument that it could.
Okay.
But it's
that's all I'm saying.
Okay, but I guess I don't go to the point where I would be upset with the person. Obviously, it could. The person that would be saying anytime somebody has more than one home.
I know that, but I don't know that I'm judging. But I don't get it. Like if think how hard it is to get $1 million, and then to get $1 million that you actually can give away. That's a life of achievement and effort and thought and good fortune, right? Now you get to do anything you want with that coin, and you're going to throw it in this big bucket with 1 million other coins. Tink. It's lost. It's, hey, we got another coin. Or you can give it to somebody and go, a coin! Wow! I want to give it to the second group.
It's interesting that you will stand up to the wealthy giving scholarships to the underprivileged at Notre Dame, but not to someone flying a dog from Seoul, South Korea to Toronto.
Have I been inconsistent again, Steve?
No.
It's 149. Mark Baser's here. You watch him on Channel 11 now and again, and he's got a... Are you still doing the talk show, the interview show?
We've got one on the TV tonight.
So this is one that you've obviously recorded.
Yeah. And it's a good one. We have Joe Flam on. Joe Flam, who is great. He is the Top Chef champion. the reigning top shelf champion. I don't think there's been a season since, but there may have been, but he just won it. He came back from the throes of he snatched whatever the expression is about snatching victory away from defeat and
jaws of defeat.
That, there you go. He was eliminated, but there's some rule that you can be eliminated and then
you do a quick fire to get back in.
Something like
or
that.
Something.
Come back. And he came back and then he ended up winning the whole thing. And he is also the executive chef at Spiaggia, which is the nice, really fancy Italian restaurant, which we can almost see from here.
Do you score a free meal when you put him on?
I did not. I went and I paid. I paid for my own meal. They gave me a free appetite, a free dish, if I remember. But I have a budget. And I took it out of my budget. I remember feeling pretty good about that. I took my wife to Spiaggia. We had a great meal.
Very
and Joe
nice.
And Joe is awesome. He's just he's a Southside guy, a regular guy. You ask him what his favorite restaurants are, he'll list off, you know, Fox's Pizza and other places on the South Side. But then he also is a chef at this one of the highest end restaurants in the city, and he's great. He's one of my favorite guests of the season. So I wanted to come on and hope people. We'll tune in at 10
what
o'clock.
What time is the show on? 10 o'clock?
10 p.m., yeah.
What day of the week is this on?
It's tonight, Thursday.
But don't they rerun it on Sunday as well?
They do. They rerun it. It's at 10:30 on Sunday. So 10 o'clock on Thursdays and then 10:30 on Sunday.
Okay, but that's not the only guest you've got. We'll finish this conversation in a minute. And read texts about pets and why we do or don't eat them. So that'll be a lot of fun. Stick around for that here on WGN. Mark Baser's interview show is on WTTW tonight at 10
p.m.
P.M. and then Sunday night at 10:30.
P.M.
You're going to interview Top Chef, for any chef?
Joe Flam, and then John Darnielle, who's the front man and the brain behind the Mountain Goats, which is a band that has a huge kind of cult following. And
the Mountain Goats are a bluegrass band.
They're not a bluegrass band. No, they're more like an indie rock band. Uh-huh. Although that's probably a very vague kind of statement about it. I don't know. It's singer-songwriter a little bit, but it'd be almost impossible for me to understand. Very eclectic, very...
They perform for you?
He didn't. It was just one guy, and we just talked in the bar. Sometimes I just, instead of having a live show... I mean, the show, we usually tape live shows where people can come out and see us do it, but then once in a while we'll have somebody who's in town, and I just want to have a conversation with them so we don't have an audience for that.
Okay, yeah, I obviously haven't seen anything like that. Usually it's the shows with an audience packed into that place because it's such a good show, and it's such a perfect venue. And you got the crowd and the laughter and the ambient sound, but this is just the two of you hanging
strobe
out at the bar.
Lights.
All right, who else is
smoke
on the show
machine
tonight?
That's it. Those two, Joe Flam and John.
Oh,
Darnielle.
That's right, because it's a half-hour show.
It's a half-hour show.
You got to blow that up. You got to get, you know, Johnny Carson used to have 90 minutes.
I know, and then it went down to an hour.
Yeah.
And now it's no minutes.
So tonight, channel 11. 10 o'clock for the interview
show. A good one. I like it.
Are you doing more shows?
We have a live show on March 1st.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
You got that lined up yet?
We do. We have a woman named Kathleen Ballou, I think it's her name. She's at the University of Chicago. She wrote a book about white power, the white power movement in the 80s and the 90s, which kind of culminated with the Timothy McVeigh Oklahoma City bombing.
Have you interviewed Christian Piccolini yet?
No. Is that the guy who wrote, you sent me the book, who kind of was in the white power movement and then
on the South Side and was just he was a nut job. He was a violent violent person who had no rudder, and now he's the most gentle, positive, empowering person you'll ever meet.
Wow.
Same guy. You would have an amazing conversation with Christian Piccolini.
My thing when I...
What's the name of his book, Aleph? Excuse me, Mark. I just want people to be able to get it. Look that up real quick. Producer Aleph, what's the name of that book when you get it, please? Keep going.
I would love to. I always, you know, part of what I like about my show, I guess, is that there's moments of levity and it can be serious and funny.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you touch on a topic like this, it's you don't want it to be completely... Where there's no jokes, there's no right. Like, how do you get to the entertainment factor? You don't really want to be entertaining about that subject.
Yeah,
it's a challenge for me going in. So,
what was the name of that book, Aleph? Do you have that for us, please?
White American Youth: My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out by Christian Piccolini.
And he's a Chicago guy.
Yeah,
still lives here.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I mean, and this didn't happen in the 1960s.
Yeah.
It happened like 10 minutes ago, so it just feels so fresh, so contemporaneous. It's stunning. She's giving me the break sign. Any other guests on your upcoming March show?
Yes, we have a woman. Her name is Abby, and I forget her last name, and I apologize. She's got a show that just got picked up at Sundance. It's a TV show that is going to be produced by one of the Wachowski duo.
What's the show about?
It's a show about somebody who's in her, kind of based on her life, somebody who's been in the improv community for a long time, and I haven't watched it yet, so I'm looking forward to watching it. So March 1st at 6:30 at the Hideout.
Get tickets at your website?
You can. Yeah, you can find a link there.
Here's where you say the name of the website.
It's theinterviewshowchicago.com.
You sound like you're making that up.
No. Somebody called me the other, or emailed me the other day asking me if I wanted to buy theinterviewshow.com. And I'm now contemplating. I want that.
How much do they want for it?
They wanted $500. And I was like, maybe I can talk them down, but it seems like it might be a scam.
Wait, the interview show. So here we go. This is the thing. Some people have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to bring dogs back from Korea. Other people are going to call and donate to you so that you can claim rightfully the name of your website.
Before you donate, and I don't think anybody will, this guy could be scamming me. So I'm just not responding.
Well, for $500, I think that's suspicious. That's cheap.
Cheap. But I'm not on NBC.
Theinterviewshow.com.
Yeah. I've wanted it for a long time. It's all I want.
You know what I would do? $500? I'd buy it and resell it. Mark Baser is on Channel 11 tonight at 10 o'clock. It's nice to see you, Mark Baser.
Thanks for having me.
Don't take my advice. I also bought Re-Elect Al Gore.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Thank you, Mark.
Here's John Williams.
That's Mark Baser. Mm-mm. In our studio once in a while. He's sometimes guested on our Mincing Rascals podcast, Channel 11 tonight. At 10 o'clock, we're in the Allstate Skyline studio until 3. The Mincing Rascals podcast recorded today will drop this afternoon around 5 o'clock, early this evening sometime. The Mincing Rascals. The Mincing Rascals were judged the best podcast in the city of Chicago. Ryan North is in our studio. He's the author of a book called How to Invent Everything. A survival guide for the stranded time traveler. He's at the Harold Washington Library in the city tonight at 6 o'clock, and he joins us in studio here on WGN. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What's the title of your book again?
How to Invent Everything, A Survival Guide for the Stranded Time Traveler.
What?
So the premise of the book is that if you get stranded in the past and your time machine breaks down,
right.
If you can't get back to the future, you can bring the future back to you by rebuilding civilization from scratch, working alone, just one person with no special education.
That's an interesting concept. Just the very first part of that. That is, we think, oh, great, the time travel, it sends you back. But, dude, if there's any problems on this end or that end, you're living in 1802.
Yeah.
Or when?
1802 is not bad. I mean, if you're living in 1802 BC, you're going to have a lot bigger challenge facing
you. Do you think, though, that we today live in the best time to ever live?
Depends on how you measure things. In terms of medicine, absolutely. Like, you don't want to get sick 400 years ago before we know what a germ is, because you're not going to have a good time.
You don't want to get a cavity 50 years ago.
No.
I mean, so what's the counter to that? Well, the medicine is great now. You're hedging on now. Why?
I mean, one of the themes of the book that I noticed doing the research for it was that there's all these moments in history where we could have invented something and didn't. Like, for example, the compass. We knew the ancient Greeks found natural magnets, saw that rocks stuck together. It took us until 1000. They discovered magnets in like 200 BCE. We invent compasses in 1000 CE. So it's over 1,000 years to make a compass, and that's just tying a rock to a string. The string lets a rock rotate freely, the rock points towards north, that's a compass. Like, tying a rock to a string took us 1,000 years. So given how we have these huge amount of times where we didn't invent stuff when we could have, it's kind of hard to say that we're living in objectively the best possible timeline right now. Like, there's always room to improve is the positive version of that.
But you also, I think, make the observation that, say, you went back 100 years or 1,000 mm-hmm. years, you could say, okay, guys, I got a great idea. iPhones. Or computers, or, you know, pick anything that's even less exotic. The leap is so great that the fact that you have that knowledge from the future does them and you no good, right?
Well, that was one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I kept sort of, it's not weird to say it's a stress situation, but I kept imagining, you know, going back in time 200 years and saying, guys, the future is great. We have penicillin and computers. And they'd say, great. How do you invent penicillin and computers?
Did you bring any?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know where to start with that. And so this book was trying to answer that. So I give instructions like, here's how you can build penicillin. Here's how you can build a computer, computational machinery. Get that ball rolling. So it's...
Really? This is in your book now.
Yeah,
you're telling the time traveler who's stuck...
The average person, here's how you make penicillin. Here's how you build a computer. What? Here's how you build civilization. I want everyone to be more competent time travelers.
What purpose does this possibly serve?
So, I mean, for me, it's that worry about time travel, the absurd worry of being stuck in the past. And I've had a lot of people say, I worry about that too. I thought I was the only one. But the positive version of this is that if you find yourself in a future in which, for example, things have collapsed, you too can make penicillin. So there's a practical, hopefully you'll never have to use it situation, and the fantasy, wouldn't it be cool if I was stuck in the past, now I can be the most important person in history situation.
I think a lot of us imagine this scenario, but yeah, they do it going forward. So if the zombies win and I'm on my own and I'm living on Earth and now there's no power because the coal plants have shut down, I mean, literally, how will I survive? And I'm thinking, well, Earth will have enough canned goods. But really, I don't know if I would even want to drive a car, because if I got in a crash, I'd have no medicine, and I'd eventually run out of gas anyway, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, how could I survive on my own?
And it's actually harder in that scenario, because we've already used up all these sort of easy-to-access resources. All the coal near the surface is gone. But if you're in 1000 BC, all that's waiting for you. So it's actually a more survivable situation to be trapped in the past than being stuck in a post-apocalyptic future.
Well, do you pick a certain time to have been stuck in the past?
No, the book lets you set up for any time period in Earth's history. So if you're there before humans evolved, before around 200,000 BCE, there's really not much of a civilization to build because it's just you inside of it. But once you have people, you can really start building something more lasting. You'll be more comfortable without people.
Really?
I mean... With the book, you'll be more comfortable.
What do you mean by that?
You can, you know, still build electricity, some engines, get some heat going. You'll be have the creature comforts to yourself.
I couldn't build electricity or engines or anything.
It's not as hard as it sounds.
How would I do that?
Oh, gosh.
Well, pick one. Pick one of these daunting tasks because...
Well, electricity. Let's do electricity. So one of the things that took us a long time to discover is the relationship between magnetism and electricity. And so if you have a magnet and you have that... centered in, let's put a magnet on a stick, and then you have wires wrapped around the magnet, so copper, so you need to do some mining at this point. But, and there's instructions how to mine. This is not the easiest thing, but you can still build it.
I'm trying to build electricity. Keep going.
By having that thing rotate, so maybe you'll use water power to make a wheel turn, gives you the rotational energy. That rotation around the magnetic core will move electrons back and forth, and that gives you alternating current.
And so I now need to find a way to tap that and then plug it into my washer dryer, which I haven't invented yet. I mean, really, what good is electric?
Earliest dryers are really interesting because they're not electrical. They're just basically a drum around a fire that you rotate. And then you cook your clothes more than dry them.
Right. So really, I guess fire would be a good one to start.
Like, fire is a great one to start. But fire actually predates humanity. Like, animals that aren't human use fire.
Say it again?
Animals that aren't humans will use fire.
Why, they'll warm themselves to
it?
Yeah. But they aren't going to make fire. They just hope there happens to be one in the woods at that time, and they'll get maybe not too close. I want to read from your Wikipedia page.
Oh, no.
Ryan North's in our studio. But you're not only the author of this, you know, bizarre survival guide, but you are also the writer of the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl for Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Since its inception in January of 2015. So that's a monthly comic book series?
Yes, she has all the powers of a squirrel and all the powers of a girl, and she fights crime.
You also are the author of, or the co-creator of, Whispered Apologies and Happy Dog the Happy Dog.
Yes. That was a children's book I wrote years ago about a happy dog where the dog learned some dour life lessons.
Speaking of dogs, so when I go to the personal life section of your wiki page, it says North once tried to stop other people named Ryan North from using his name in a series of satirical email. He also got into trouble with authorities by sending prank email. On August 18th, 2015, North became stuck in a skate pit with only an umbrella, a leash, his phone, and his dog, Noam Chomsky. After rain made the surface too slick to easily climb out with the dog in tow, he posted about his conundrum on Twitter, leading hundreds of Twitter users to reply with suggestions on how to combine the items in his inventory to escape, eventually leading to success.
Yes.
Is any of that true?
100% true. So it was a skate bowl, imagine like a dried out swimming pool. And some really cool graffiti, so I hopped in with my dog and took some pictures of my dog, because that's what I do, and couldn't get out. And so I posted saying, you know, hypothetically, if I had gotten stuck in this hole.
I have a friend.
Yeah,
asking for a friend.
And people started giving me suggestions. A lot of them, you know, did not help. One person suggested making a sling out of my shirt to carry Chomsky in, but...
That still doesn't get you out of the pool, though.
Well, it gave me two hands to climb out, because the problem was that Chomsky only had one hand. The problem is a sling would work for like a chihuahua, but not a large-sized dog. So now I was topless and stuck in a hole, which hadn't really increased my predicament.
Yeah.
But...
how'd you get out?
So the trick was, I had the umbrella, the Chomsky's on a leash. I climb out of the hole with my two hands, which was possible, holding his leash connected to the umbrella, which lengthened the length of the leash. So I could then reach the edge of the pool with him still attached to my hands. And then using the... He had a harness, so he wasn't choking him.
Right.
Using harness to pull him up, the leash to support his rear end... We get out. It took about an hour for Twitter to figure out how to get me out of the hole.
It's a good thing you have Twitter followers.
Yeah. Well, people are like, why don't you call the police or the fire department? And I was like, they're busy. Like, I don't want to say, hey, guys, it's me. I'm stuck in a hole.
This is embarrassing.
Yeah.
I have a dog named
I'd rather much
Chomsky.
Publicly escape the hole. It's much
yeah,
less embarrassing.
Right. That was an upgrade. Your Twitter page continues. On November 8th, 2006, Ryan North launched the site Every Topic in the Universe Except Chickens, which purports to provide a solution to vandalism on Wikipedia. Vandalism on Wikipedia is mm-hmm. where false stuff is posted. I've been the victim of that. A lot of people have.
Sure.
In that it encourages vandals to vandalize only the article on chickens. Quote, instead of vandalizing Wikipedia in general, we all just vandalized the chicken article. North reasoned that it was worth trading the reliability of the chicken article if it meant freeing the rest of the encyclopedia from the threat of vandalism because, quote, dudes already know about chickens. The site received considerable media attention.
You never know what'll get people's attention.
I don't think that's such a crazy... I mean, that's a crazy idea, but there's a little bit of logic in that, too.
The chickens page is still semi-protected to this day.
We don't want people coming in and posting bad stuff about chickens.
Yeah.
I had a teacher once who, as a little thought experiment to our, I think, sixth grade class, I believe it was at the N.O. Nelson Grade School in Edwardsville, Illinois, and she said, okay, you're on an island, and you get to have one thing to help you survive. What will it be?
Right.
That sort of borrows from your conceit for your book.
Take my book.
And a lot of people said, shovel. And she said, what are you going to do? Dig your grave? How is a shovel going to help you survive? But I think a lot of us imagined we'd be, I don't know, digging crops or I don't know what we're going to do. But I mean, what are we going to do? And matches were an option. But
nobody said like teleporter.
Yeah. Jet airplane, helicopter would be nice. Yeah. But I mean, that was the kind of thought experiment we were all engaged in. And it's kind of what you were engaged in, too. But the book is doing, it has an audience, doesn't
it? Yeah. Part of the fun of the book was trying to figure out what to put in it. Because, I mean, the title promises a lot, how to invent everything. And I've got some people emailing me saying, hey, why didn't you put this in? The title's a lie. And I'm like, you got me. I didn't put everything in here. But figuring out, like, what is the important part? And on top of that, what is the important things that one person can reasonably invent in one lifetime?
Well, and isn't it kind of fascinating to think about that? I mean, the success of the book written by the internet about how a man would survive on Mars
mm-hmm.
was not only a great book, but a great movie.
Andy Weir, yeah.
And it was believable.
Yeah. That was the challenge with the book, was I wanted it to be like, you read it for fun, it's entertaining, it's funny, it's a lot of cool facts, a lot of cool history, a lot of cool stories, but I also wanted it to be like a sincere effort to help you if you're stranded in the past, just like The Martian was a very sincere, science-heavy book on how to survive on Mars if you're stranded with some potato seeds and a
exactly.
greenhouse.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of feeling to it.
My number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, you can call or text. If you have a question or an observation or feelings about chickens, and if we'll pause, answer this when we come back. But if I do go back and I could bring something with me, I don't know if you consider that in your book. Tell me what I should bring. Ryan North is in our studio. Ryan North is the author of How to Invent Everything, a survival guide for the stranded time traveler. He's at the Harold Washington Library tonight at 6. If you saw her on stage, you'd never know why losing her sight has never changed her artistic vision. That's tonight's cover story on WGN TV News at 9. All right, Ryan, so before the break, I tasked you with, you've got to go back in time. To when, and what are you going to bring?
So, I think I have an answer for you. You go back in time to, let's say, 1400s, and what you bring with you is the knowledge that you can treat and cure scurvy with vitamin C.
How about that?
Because we have learned that and forgotten that dozens of times through history.
Oh, really?
It keeps happening. We discover it, and we forget how it works, and then we have to rediscover it. And there's so many people who have died from scurvy, like super preventable, that just that knowledge could save millions.
So if the sailors traveling from Europe to the New World had just brought crates of oranges.
Yeah, it would be very different.
Or if they had just been nicer people. I mean, that's the one.
There's a lot of room for improvement in that era of history.
You know, the books have been written, too. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but they say as bad as it is now with terrorism and everybody's just so upset about everything these days, this really is the heyday of humanity that life for most humans is as good now as it's ever been.
If you consider the purpose of civilization to make humans and their really productive human brains alive and comfortable, we've got more human brains now than we ever have. Like, that's a success. There's certainly room for improvement, so all these human brains are happy and well-fed and stuff, but
what was the hardest thing to try and convince people to, or for you to imagine, I go back to 1800 or 1400 or 200,000 years ago when humanity is evolving. What was the hardest thing to imagine that we could concoct? You told me how I could generate electricity.
Yeah. I always wanted the book to end with computers because I felt like that is a cool thing to invent out of schedule. And I studied computer science in school, and I had to sort of convince myself that you could build working computational machinery out of properly arranged water and pipes. And once you have that sort of idea of, because computers are amazing, right? What you're doing is you're turning mechanical action, like turning a crank or plugging electricity in, into calculation, into a type of thought. And that is the ultimate dream. Many of the inventions we make for humans are to be lazier. I don't want to do this. I'll make a machine that threshes my grain. I don't want to think. I'll make a computer that does my sums for me. Like, that is the ultimate expression of, let this be done by machine.
You think? You ever think about this thought too? How fortunate humanity is that Bill Gates was born when he was, and not 100 or 200 years earlier. Or do you think, gee, too bad Leonardo da Vinci wasn't born now? Think of what he would have come up
with. Well, it's interesting because you look at when inventions happen, and sometimes it seems like it's in the air, where like the telephone, you had a couple people going along similar vein at similar times.
That was going to happen.
Yeah, and sometimes it's a step forward where no one was thinking of this, and then suddenly we have this, and that changes the world. Like penicillin is an example of that, where it's there, and now the world's different than it was before. Miracle drug. So it really depends on the technology being discovered, being created.
Some of our texts include these. I've thought about if I could go back in time and bring one item with me, what would it be? This person says, if I bring the book that this man just wrote in electronic form, will I be able to read it if I travel in the past? P.S. My brain now hurts. And 630 says, in the Outlander books, Claire brings antibiotics with her when she travels back in time.
That's good.
I told you off the air, I asked Thomas Jefferson that on stage, or somebody did one day, and he said the same thing, antibiotics. What a fun idea. So he's at the Harold Washington Library tonight at 6 o'clock. Travel by any means available to you to the Harold Washington Library tonight. How to Invent Everything, a survival guide for the stranded time traveler. Ryan North, what a pleasure. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
So thanks also to our last guest, Ryan North. That was fun. How to Invent Everything, a survivalist guide for the stranded time traveler. By the way, I just want to play one little piece of audio. Steve, I heard most of your news, but I was doing two things while you were doing it.
That's okay.
How much of the Eddie Johnson, the Chicago Police Department police superintendent, audio did you play from the press conference?
Played a little bit at 2 o'clock, but nothing at 2:30.
Elif, I just dropped it in our file. See if you can pull it up. I think it's labeled Chief. We recorded the Mincing Rascals podcast a few minutes ago, before the show today in the 11 o'clock hour. It'll drop at 5 o'clock tonight. It's our weekly roundtable discussion about the news with people from the Tribune and here at WGN Radio. Judge, the best podcast in the city of Chicago, right? And one of the segments we did was on the Aurora shooting versus the
Jussie Smollett
story, and how screwed up it is that the big story in Chicago continues to be Smollett. CNN is going live with it right now. I mean, there's Jussie Smollett walking out of the courthouse right now, and it's live, live, live. And we are not, maybe because we just don't know what else to say anymore, talking about the shooting in Aurora. But this has gotten a disproportionate amount of coverage, I'll just say that. And the Rascals kicked that around. The podcast will drop at 5 o'clock this evening, which is kind of timely in a way, because in our studio right now is Dave Cullen. He is the author of a book called Parkland. He wrote Columbine as well. He's in Chicago. He's talking about his book this evening, and he joins us on WGN. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, you note in the book, you go, I'm the mass shooting guy, and whenever there's a mass shooting, my phone starts ringing. That happened certainly in the case of Parkland after you wrote the book about Columbine. What were your thoughts when you heard about Aurora, Illinois, and the workplace shooting?
I couldn't believe it. And immediately, so I thought immediately the other Aurora, and I thought, oh my God, somebody shot at the same place twice? But now this is almost more horrible. That so now anytime somebody talks about the Aurora shooting, we have to ask which one. And also, it's a little horrifying the how the press coverage comes and goes like nothing. So I live in New York. I live a couple blocks from Radio City, and they always text me right away. So they texted me, I think, at 3:43. Could you get over here right away?
After Aurora, Illinois?
Yes, during. Well, it was in progress. Yeah, in the afternoon. And I said, I'll be right over. I put my jacket on. I got there about 15 minutes later. By the time I got to 30 Rock, they texted me, we decided we're already pivoting away from it. right? And so it was about a 15-minute national story. And they're like, well, another shooting. Okay.
It's hard to keep track of them. I mean, I think a lot of us have caught ourselves where somebody says, well, do you remember the California one or the Florida one? And you go, yeah, wait, which one was that? You know, and I
get them confused in that. Sometimes I hate myself, but the victims of them can't keep them straight. Who can? By the way, one of the things in the book when I was researching PTSD and how it affected different kinds of people, I asked a psychiatrist who specializes in it, and she said, well, there's data definitely on, rapes and assaults. There probably isn't on mass murder because there's probably not enough data and too recent. Then the next day, she emailed me back, oh, there is data on mass murder. We have actually studied the impacts of trauma on mass murderers. There's a category for it. Somebody's done that research already. That should not exist.
Dave Cullen wrote Columbine, now Parkland, and Heidi Stevens is going to interview him at Women and Children First event at the Swedish American Museum tonight at 7 o'clock. After Columbine, you wrote about Columbine. What happened to you? How hard was writing that book for you?
Well, I usually don't talk about this because I don't want to sound... Obviously, it's way worse than the people there, so I was sort of like a bystander, but... I had the first year I had secondary PTSD, which I didn't know existed, but it does. And that took me down pretty bad. And I got treated for that. 7 years later, it was much worse. Because I guess I didn't, like most people, I didn't take it seriously enough and thought I was fine. And barely recovered from that. And I agreed to a lot of conditions with my shrink never to do certain things again, which then, of course, I violated for this book.
But the idea was that you weren't going to immerse yourself too much in the horror of this story.
Exactly.
And so when you wrote Parkland then, and we are just now a year and a few days since the Parkland shooting, you don't dwell on the chaos in the school.
Exactly. Or the shooter. I refuse to name the shooter in the book.
Do you think we should all start to refrain from that in the media?
Totally. And I think, well, it makes sense. And, Anderson Cooper refuses to name, and I do his show all the time. He does really great coverage, but when it makes sense. So occasionally, especially when the person's still at large, the FBI asks them, please name him so we can find or we can find information on this person. So where it makes sense, of course, but maybe once a show, if that, or zero. Especially images is even more important for the TV people. Just come on, that visual wallpaper where they just shows it in the background, yeah. Which the only purpose is to raise the blood pressure of everybody watching.
So you write then this book about Parkland, and you don't dwell on the shooting, but you start there, and then within a handful of pages, we're talking about the movement that the kids created to do something about it. And you got a whole book out of that.
Yeah, and that's why I went down there. You know, I went down there just to cover for Vanity Fair, and I said 5 weeks, not a minute more, because I was late for already a book on two gay soldiers. And but then when I was down there, I discovered there's so much more to it. There's so much more. It's sort of like being backstage with them. You know, we feel like they did this amazing thing, but it's almost like a magic act. Like Emma Gonzalez just became, you know, this overnight sensation. It's like there's so many reasons why that fascinated me that I wanted to share that story.
Emma Gonzalez is the striking young woman who had her head shaved before all of this. She said, my hair was too unruly. I just didn't like it, so I shaved it. She said, my parents didn't want me to, so I did a PowerPoint presentation. What a thoroughly modern teenager's approach. We used to just stomp our feet and run out the door, but now they do PowerPoint to persuade their parents that the girls can shave their heads. So that's Emma Gonzalez. David Hogg is another one of the noteworthy names. But your then story is say, okay, this has happened, and you take us from that moment to, say, the massive rally in Washington, D.C.
Yes, and then in Chicago, actually a huge amount of the story is set here in Chicago, and a key scene out in Naperville. I'm going to be, by the way, at Anderson's Books tomorrow at Naperville, but that's a key scene set there. So the peace march last summer is where they decided to kick off their summer tour because of what's happening in the south side of Chicago and the west side of Chicago. And I have a whole chapter called The Peace Warriors, which is an amazing group of kids in, oh God, is it North Lawndale?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, who have been doing amazing work for years, getting no media attention. In fact, two of the guys from that then were on the stage at the March for Our Lives march in D.C. They came out on the stage with neon colored duct tape over their mouths and ripped it off, which I thought was the perfect metaphor because that's how they felt. They have been saying these same things that they said in their speech for years, and America had no idea. It was like they didn't exist out there, and now they had a voice. And the Parkland kids really merged their movement with the kind of the urban movement in all these cities across America who have already been fighting gun violence. They worked very closely with them and made them part of the movement. And it's about all kids, not just, you know, white suburban affluent kids. They understood their privilege and realized there's more, excuse me, but black and brown kids dying in the cities than us, and we want to work with them and solve this for all kids of all colors.
The kids seemed to make a lot of good decisions. They were also criticized that they were being used as a puppet by Hollywood or the left wing. There's a part early in the book where you talk about how they had a goal. They said, how much money can we raise? What are all expenses be? $2 million. Well, the big women's rally after the election generated $1 million plus. So let's not do two. We'll do one. That's crazy, but we'll do one. And son of a gun, the funds were coming in. And they, you know, you're not sure where they're going to get it. But then you remind us that George Clooney just said, by the way, what you people are doing is inspiring. Here's $500,000. And then Oprah Winfrey said, here's $500,000. And suddenly they got $2 million in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the right starts to, I hate to say the right because I don't want to over-politicize mm-hmm. this, but the people who thought there was something inauthentic about this said, wait a minute, this looks fishy to me.
Mm-hmm. And what they forget is they had already raised about $2 million within 2.5 or 3 days before those came in, and they took it. I think those liberal people, like Clooney and Oprah, had figured out they tried to do things many times on their own, and it shouldn't be them doing it. They shouldn't be. But
who's they?
Themselves, like
the
Clooney
adults.
And Oprah. Yeah, the adults.
And by the way, how much good has it done, right?
Right, exactly. But I think when they thought, like, wow, here are kids doing it for themselves. Here are amazing kids. Let's get on board and help
and
them
the kids,
do their
and,
thing.
And
why
they were making
we
decisions
them?
On their own. For instance, okay, so if you're David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez and any of these other Parkland kids down there in Florida, and suddenly Anderson Cooper wants you on TV, should you put on a suit or not? When you do a rally, should you dress up and look like this is serious or should you not? I don't know the answer to that, but they did, didn't they?
They did. They decided right away, let's dress as kids. Let's be ourselves. And they also... They're really bright kids. They talked about it. Like, you know what? When you put on a suit, you put on a dress, You change your personality slightly. You tell yourself this and like, oh no, I have to act more uptight or more like an adult. Without knowing it, you send subtle cues to yourself. I'm like, no, we're going to be kids. We're going to be ourselves. We're going to stay authentic. And by the way, that whole thing about like, you know, my editor from Vanity Fair, I went down the first weekend. He said, I was wondering, like, maybe somebody is helping them. They're almost too good to be true. See if you can sniff that out, find out. And in about a week, I was like, well, I'm not sure yet, but like, I should like, I can't imagine anyone telling them what to do. And after a month, I'm like, no freaking way. By the way, you know, one of the people, oh, maybe the Hillary people are doing it. The Hillary people should have been so lucky. I'm sorry for Hillary supporters, but like, she would be in the White House now if these kids were running her campaign. Like,
grassroots marketing, things like that.
Amazing.
Oh, so here's an example. You point this out, and I just think it shows how, I don't even know if clever is the right word. It's almost intuitive, right?
Exactly.
A high school kid gets it. Hillary doesn't. Traditional media doesn't. But 1 month after, this is just amazing to me. I don't remember all of this. But 1 month after Parkland, the NRA put out a picture of a gleaming, you write, AR-15. And then they came with the phrase, I'll control my own guns, thank you. And it was sort of like a little subtle pushback. You know, we still have the Second Amendment. I don't need to explain that text to you, right? So the NRA throws that out. What happens after that?
Remind me. I remember that one, but I don't even. There's so many, I can't even remember them all. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. Tell me.
Well, the kids then, so then they just kind of kick it around. And like you said, chaos. No organizational meeting. Somebody goes, what do you want to do in it? How about this? How about this? How about this? One kid takes a screen grab, finds a way to edit it on his phone. And the next thing you know, they came up with, I'll control my own life, thank you. Which is just a perfect twist on that with a picture of a protester. And they did it on their phone. And instead of a marketing meeting that would have cost $500,000 in New York for a week, these kids just had the perfect response in an hour. And then a couple of them said, okay, who's going to send it out? They picked two, and boom, there go the refollows and the retweets.
Exactly. And that was Dylan Byerlein, who I call him and Matt the memes man, because I, you know, actually, yeah. So that's when I decided I was going to actually maybe do a book, is the first time I got into their, they let me into their secret headquarters, which was still, and, you know, so Jackie Korn, who's sort of the hero of the book, who's like this untold person behind the scenes making it all happen.
Who is she? A student?
No, she's a student. She's one of the core groups. She's one of the five who's on the cover of Time magazine. But she's the implementer. So they're all these creative kids. They're like drama kids and news kids. They're like a bunch of creatives. And picture them like trying to actually put on a show. Like, so they had, so she was the junior class president who like actually like makes everything happen. So she let me in, and you know, she took me on a little tour, and she's like, "This room, here's this room, and like here's the writer's room." Like, the writer's room.
Well, it was one of the mom's houses that they had holed up in, right?
Originally, Cameron Caskey's living room. Yeah, and then this is when they got an office, and they didn't let the media know about it. But I had sort of like, they trusted me, and they took me inside. And then, you know, she's like, the writer's room. I'm thinking of the writer's room. And then, so I interviewed Matt Deitch, who another one of the students. And he's like, let's go back in the writer's room. And then I was like, the writer's room? And he looked at me, what, do you think this stuff's writing itself? And then I learned about Dylan and how they did this. I'm like, oh, that's why you're so successful. There's so much more going on here.
Why did David Hogg get so much pushback?
Well, two reasons. First of all, because he was an incredible threat. He was immediately like powerful, and but also David is aggressive and can be abrasive, and he pushes sometimes too hard, especially in the early days. He had a hell of a lot of anger. I just did a Christiane Amanpour show with him where I hadn't seen him in a couple months. It's almost like a new David. He's calmed down. He's gotten there. But in those early months, he was on fire angry. And he would say some harsh things.
I felt bad for those kids. I mean, obviously, right? But I thought, wait a minute. These kids are suddenly being asked to combat Sean Hannity on issues that weren't all that important to them, weren't day-to-day issues for them 10 minutes ago. So, and now they're being criticized for either not making salient enough points. Was it Judge Pirro said, come on, I'll debate you. And I thought, don't take that bait and don't challenge that kid that way. But there they were. And I worried about their mental health. How are the kids? Answer this while we come back. It's 2:50. Okay. In our studio right now is the author of Maybe You Read His Bestseller, Columbine. Now, Dave Cullen has Parkland. It'll debut in the New York Times bestseller list this weekend. And his latest book is what he's talking about in Chicago. He's talking to Heidi Stevens at the Swedish American Museum tonight at 7 at Women and Children First. So tell me how the kids are doing in a minute. If you've been listening to our conversation, you might imagine that Dave Cullen is still talking. He's the author of the book Columbine. That was a bestseller. Now Parkland, about the Parkland shooting, will be on the New York Times bestseller list. Do you know where you're debuting? This is a trivial point, but where will we see the book?
Number 14.
You will not unseat Michelle Obama's book because she's number one recorded, number one hardback, number one combined.
She is forever. And I'm debuting two places below Toni Morrison's debut. Two below a Nobel Prize winner, so that's pretty good.
Not bad. Well, this is amazing writing and reporting. We don't have a lot of time, but so you tell the story from the moment of the Parkland shooting in Florida, and you take us through Chicago and through Tallahassee and eventually to Washington, D.C. Can you give me any metrics? Because they had certain goals, like can we raise $2 million? Can we get 500,000 people there? How, quote-unquote, successful was the students' activism?
Incredibly successful in so many different ways. Like they saw the midterm elections as the first big goal, but the first battle of many years of doing this. They see this as a generational struggle. But that first election, the biggest thing was young people and getting them to turn out. In the previous midterm, the results are pitiful. I hate saying out loud, but 21% was the people under 30 who voted in the previous midterm. This time it was 31%, the highest ever recorded since people below 21 got the vote. And a 50% increase from the previous. So that was fantastic. In the midterms, what are some of the other key figures? Hardly anybody ever voted on guns. The biggest problem was asymmetrical voting. So 5 to 10% of the people voted on guns as an issue, almost all on the gun, pro-gun side. And liberals don't vote on guns, never have. And it never even showed up on the exit polls. This time, for the first time in the history of exit polling, gun safety came in fourth, ahead of Afghanistan and global warming and
Also pointed out in the book that for the first time, you could probably phrase this better than I can, but the NRA's spending was eclipsed by the gun safety side, that suddenly people were donating to that cause versus the great advocacy that the NRA has enjoyed. How many students were at the rally, or how many people were at the rally in Washington?
You know, estimates wildly vary from like 300,000 to 800,000, but that was in D.C. The thing is, they had almost 800 sibling marches here and around the country, and it's about 2.5 million nationwide, which puts it in a virtual tie with the biggest, in third or fourth place in American history, in a virtual tie with the biggest one-day rally of the Vietnam War era, which took a decade of people in their 20s. This is high school students did it in 5 weeks.
How are those students doing?
Mostly well. It varies, obviously, and there are certain people still struggling. We talked about David. He's doing so much better. And I really measure his sister, Lauren, which, by the way, a lot of David's anger came from the fact that every day he came home from school or what he was doing, and Lauren, who was a freshman and lost four close friends, was devastated and was a complete wreck. And he saw her in the house, and that just fired him. Like, he talks about he was doing it because she was the face of this to him. So I saw Lauren about every 3 to 4 weeks over most of last year. Each time I saw her, she looked dramatically better. And in May, it was prom day, I actually talked to her about it to say, is this, what I'm seeing? She said, yes, definitely. And she still talked about some breakdowns. But then I talked to her mom, Rebecca, later that afternoon and said, yeah, but she's still having nightmares.
I can imagine. We're out of time. Dave Cullen's book, he wrote Columbine, now has Parkland. He's at the Swedish American Museum tonight at 7. You're in Naperville tomorrow as well. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, at Anderson Bookshop. Yeah, yeah.
Dave, nice writing.
Thank you.
I was in tears at times reading this book. I don't do this often, but literally today as I was walking down the streets of Chicago, I had my nose in the book. And I thought, it's icy. I have to be careful. I'm going to walk in front of a bus. But the book is really compelling and well told from an angle you did not anticipate. Nice of you to come into our studio.
Thank you so much for having me, John. And this is my—I grew up here, so it's great to be home.
Hi, guys.
We are indeed ready. Hi. Indeed, Reddy.
How are you?
Couldn't be better. We were just watching Jussie Smollett, trying to get out of 26 in California. His family got out. He has brothers and other siblings of some sort that were able to get out. And the media scrum chased them out, thinking they may have been Jussie, even though he didn't look anything. The brothers don't look anything like him. It was like the craziest thing.
Well, you saw them break when they were looking at the scrum of reporters and the huge press of people there, and then all of a sudden they left and they tried to go out another door, but you can't really go out another door.
Is he going to apologize?
He has to. Although his attorneys, we are told, at least it's
sometimes it's reporting that the attorney is saying he wants to clear his name. So.
They said he enjoys the presumption of innocence. And I'm thinking, yeah.
No, I don't think he's enjoying it. But I think that's not accurate.
Good luck to you on that. You guys got a lot to do. Yes, I'm going to get out of the way. Have a terrific show.
All right, coming up, we'll take you right to that, to the courtroom. Also, Ben Bradley's going to join us. And Brett Baer, all in the next half hour right here.